Coming up on AI Having a Clue.
We explore the AI resist list.
The amount of wealth in Silicon Valley and through those, you know, few big companies, we are always going to be lackeys to that. There is nothing we can do. They've built an empire. There isn't competition anymore.
And viva la AI revolution.
Revolution is for the people. But the AI revolution is not actually a revolution. I don't think that AI is making things better for most people.
I'll tell you what, Back to the Future 2 lied. Hello and welcome to AI Haven't a Clue, brought to you with KPMG. I am AI novice George Butler.
Yeah, and AI black belt James Chandler.
Well, we're going to put your black belt credentials to the test today as we are joined by a guest who is, I think, possibly the most anti-AI guest we've ever had. Because it's really important, joking aside, to explore different viewpoints, different perspectives, and different takes on what this AI craziness is doing to the world. And we have a lot of people on who are experts or enthusiasts, and sometimes we need to just take a second and go, what's going on here?
No, we've certainly done that, my friend.
We do. We brought Tanya Duarte onto the show. Now, Tanya is a good friend with a good friend of the show, Karen Howe, who's been on, a fantastic journalist, who's written a brilliant book about OpenAI and their kind of empire building.
Yep.
Now, together, they've started this thing called the AI Resist List, which we're going to dive into. Tanya is also founder of We and AI, which is a non-for-profit helping everyday people understand and have a say in how AI shapes our world. And she's a leading voice in responsible AI.
She has been named as one of the 100 brilliant women in AI ethics and one of Computer Weekly's most influential women in UK tech. It is a fascinating listen. Enjoy, Tanya.
Thank you so much for joining us on AI Haven't a Clue.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Pleasure.
We're going to be talking all about some of the big projects you're involved with. We and AI, the AI Resist List. But before we dive into all of that, it would be really great to hear a bit about your background. What got you into this sector? Where did your career start? I know you kind of mentioned about 5 or 6 years ago, you moved into the non-for-profit side of things. But tell us about your career.
Sure. So I'm quite old, so it's been quite a long one. But I actually started in publishing back in the 1990s, went to do an MBA and then worked in kind of management consultancy, marketing, and always loved innovation. So did a lot in, you know, kind of go to market, fast growth, and naturally ended up in tech. Yeah, kind of increasingly became aware of the gap between the way that we were making money. So the last commercial role that I had, we actually had a information for business leaders, CTOs, CEOs about emerging and disruptive technologies. And it was really well read, you know, we sold it in the end. So we did a lot of articles, an article every day. We had a print magazine, we ran, you know, conferences, we did roundtables, etc. And I could see that there was a huge interest in AI. So out of all the other things we were talking about, you know, nanotechnology and, you know, 3D printing was like huge at the time, you know, all of these things, 3D printing.
Oh, halcyon days.
Big data, you know, before it's. But I could see from the analytics that as soon as we put out an article that was like 10 ways AI will revolutionize, insert your industry here, that I could see everyone was getting super, super excited. And kind of, you know, my role at the time was to get people excited about it. And so we would just regurgitate press releases and hype them up. Yeah. And seeing the way that the gap of knowledge that people actually had about A, how these things actually worked. They were just jumping on the, you know, like, oh, I've got an AI, everything. And this is back in the, you know, 2017, never mind now. Yeah. And then the complete lack of awareness of the harms that were coming down the road. So at the time, we were most concerned about algorithmic bias. There are now many other things that we're concerned about. But at the time, I felt that there was a big, like, mismatch.
So a decade ago, you were getting excited about it and you were kind of helping a lot more people get excited about AI. Fast forward to 2026. Are you still excited by AI?
No. No, and it's not it's not because I'm any less excited about the prospect of things that can make things better for people. But what's changed is that I don't think that AI is making things better for most people. I think there's some people that are doing very well. I think they're a very small group of people. And I think there's a large amount of deluded people who think that it, you know, they will at some point reap some benefits that actually they're never going to see, and they're certainly not seeing now. So I think that the excitement came from genuinely thinking that disrupting the status quo, you know, new business models, new ways of democratizing this and that, you know, removing barriers, being able to find your own space. And, you know, this all sounded like this was positive, progressive change. And then what we've seen happen is the opposite to all of that. We've seen a concentration and consolidation of power. We've seen, you know, growing wealth inequality. We've seen all the things that, you know, we enjoy doing, like, you know, the creative things. Being, you know, kind of basically turned into slop and, you know, jobs lost. Whereas the things that we, you know, less keen on doing, we thought AI was going to be there for, they're not necessarily the things that AI is being used for. So I think it's less about, it's less a change in excitement. It's more a realization that a lot of the stories and the narratives that, you know, I was very, very part of creating were a lot of spin with not so much understanding of you know, actually what's this going to look like for real people, not just the, you know, billionaires of the world.
You know, almost the potential still that it has is incredible to do all of those positive things. What sort of happened? What happened to all that potential of the things that it could do for us, you know, creatively, take away all the boring bits, the promise that it can free up more time in our day to think creatively and think critically? What about all that stuff? Is it, what's got in the way of all that stuff coming to fruition, I guess? Is it pure greed from people? Is it, it's just not designed for everyone?
The first thing I'd say is that some of them are just not proven, you know. So some of the things that we were told, you know, back, you know, you're going to have, you know, self-driving cars by 2019. I mean, I'm pretty sure I commissioned an article, you know, on that, you know.
Tell you what, Back to the Future 2 lied.
Yeah, we need to chat about films. I'll tell you about those later.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things actually, like, are not, and even now, quite often when you say, yeah, but, you know, where, what actually is it? People say, oh, cure for cancer, or what about protein folding? And it's like, well, okay, when great, when's that bit happening then? And actually, the whole protein folding, you know, kind of AlphaGo thing, they've actually just shut down that whole division. So, you know, some of the core arguments, yes, people, accessibility, I think, is the one that people now say, like, you know, what are the good things that happen? For some people with accessibility issues, yes, I think that's probably the best use case. But the flip side of that is people say, oh, no, but it's making me more productive. So there are good things because it's making me more productive. And this is my second, well, it's the first point I'd make in terms of what happened. You asked, you know, why has this not come to pass on a wider scale than a few people, you know, kind of benefiting from an accessibility point of view, is that the productivity, the people that think they're benefiting from the productivity, it's like, who are you being productive for? So, okay, so say you're in a business, you are doing more work. Maybe someone else in the business is also having to unpick your mess. Maybe down the line, you're going to find that actually you need to spend more money to unpick a load of mess. But, you know, even aside from, okay, you're faster now, are you getting paid more? Is there more work for you to do? Is your work better?
You're going to work yourself out of a job.
Who's,
the more you offload,
who are you training?
AI,
yeah, exactly. It's like, so how is your life better? So I think it's not necessarily a question of, like, does this thing have some benefits? Yes, probably, but for whom?
Yeah.
So at the same time, as a few people are like, hey, this is really great. I'm having fun. So maybe I'm not more productive, right? Maybe I'm just having more fun because I can, you know, put in a prompt and come up with something crazy, and that's great fun and, you know, empowers me. Then it's a question of, like, well, what's the cost of that? So that's where you get into, you know, we're here kind of maybe thinking about the AI resist list and the degree of backlash, is because the cost of that fun actually is so serious for so many people that it's, and most people don't realize that yet. It's like the benefit for society is not there. And actually, yeah, maybe now you're having fun, but you're also probably complaining about the heat or the, you know, the hose pipe ban.
Let's come on to, can you tell us a little bit about the organization that you founded, We End AI?
Sure. So to try and fill that kind of gap of public understanding of, you know, seeing the things that I'd seen, that there was, you know, a lot of people were just jumping on bandwagons, listening to, you know, people like me, or, you know, certainly the people that at the time were, you know, had an agenda of trying to sell stuff. Yeah. So that's the issue, right? The system is the issue. AI is about making money for people. It's not about public good. Mm. And so that's why the whole narrative that we were selling at the time, which is like, hey, this is going to be great for, you know, you and W, it's never going to work because the people that are making AI generally are not doing it for your good. Companies are there to make money. They are there for shareholder value. Yeah. And politicians that I speak to don't seem to understand that. They think, oh, no, well, we'll work with the businesses because the businesses know, you know, the best thing to do. And it's like, no, do your job. Your job is to look after people. The business is to look after the shareholder. Mm. And that's what I think's gone wrong. Mm. So I wanted to fill that gap to, you know, basically say to people, well, look, if we've got AI technology, we need to think about how do people benefit from this, rather than being, you know, listening to being told that it's going to make our life better, even though fundamentally that's not where the money is. So we did some work. So the organization, I didn't answer your question. Sorry, I'm on a rant. So the organization's called We and AI, and the aim was to give people information about AI that wasn't this like hypey type of, you know, information. Even though at the time we genuinely believed, you know, we believed the hype. We thought this was a good thing. But it was more about like, okay, these are potential risks. This is the problem when you have a very small group of people in Silicon Valley who have immense wealth, who are able to influence policy and the rest of it. These are the issues. But now you understand, you know, if we can tell you more about technology, now maybe you can say how it should be used. That could be either in terms of what do we want to design? What do we, you know, what kind of technology would be useful to us? What kind of problems do we have that people, that the very small group of people that, you know, currently are controlling AI, maybe they don't have those problems. So if we, you know, we think about what problems we have that could be solved, maybe we have more, you know, more power. Or it could be a question of becoming activated to start asking difficult questions about actually whose interests at play here, or how much data do we want to give up, or, you know, how, what kind of level of bias or risk do we think is acceptable. So this was our kind of theory of change at the time. We tell people, and part of that was to enable people to say, you know, what good AI, air quoting there, should look like, because that was my first answer to the question, like, how, you know, what is it? The first thing is like, you need to have people involved in what it says. Now, I've got a little bit more cynical over time because it's been clear that actually just giving people information about how the technology works, how it could be worked, you know, maybe the things that it could do, what, how it could help people, actually doesn't really change anything, because the systems, the infrastructure isn't there for that public input to actually make a difference. The power asymmetry is so great that just having knowledge and information actually isn't very helpful, because the big companies have found a way that, you know, the big AI companies, big technology companies are just about, you know, raising VC capital and, you know, kind of racing each other. And frankly, there's just, just like, don't really care.
We've obviously, you know, the kind of the way in which the world works now, we've had for several decades business having a real impact on everyday life, and business kind of being maybe the primary force driving society forward in many ways, and certainly being a one of the kind of the key ways in which culture and the way we live is shaped. Do you think we are in a more dangerous situation now with big tech existing and the way that AI is infiltrating our world? Or do you actually just think it's kind of always been this way? It's just a different technology entering our lives.
I mean, to some extent, it's always been this way, you know, because people, you know, with power and wealth will have a natural advantage in accumulating more wealth and power. You know, that is to some extent always been there. What's different? And I think there is a big difference now. And there have been books written. So Yanis Varoufakis wrote Techno-Feudalism, and his argument is that we are no longer in capitalism. So we kind of kid ourselves that this is capitalism. Capitalism has always been like this. And, you know, politicians will think, oh, the market will sort it out. But the thing is, we have so much power from the big companies that they have actually turned us back into this feudal system. Or as Karen Howe in her book Empire of AI writes, you know, it's kind of, they've built an empire. So actually there isn't competition anymore. I mean, they've managed to have enough power to get rid of in the UK, for example, the competition authorities, you know, stuff that they actually managed to get rid of the infrastructure that is meant to keep competition there, to give consumers the ability to say, well, actually, we don't want this. You know, that's what's meant to work. It's like, well, if something is not good, then people won't buy it, you know, but actually that has now gone because there's so much money available that we convince people, you know, the black is white and they do want something that, yes, they may, you know, kind of be literally burning alive at the moment, but like, this is what you want because there's utopia coming. And secondly, that any dissenting voices are, you know, the way that funding works and, you know, agendas and, you know, you listen to any kind of government agendas, you know, certainly not just, but certainly in the UK, the language used, they've managed to get control of the language. It's all about the AI revolution. You think of the use of the word revolution there, it makes you feel like this is your thing, right? Revolution is for the people. But the AI revolution is not actually a revolution. Yeah. It's saying, you have to put this technology in anything. We want you to be more efficient. We want, in fact, to be more so efficient, we don't need you. And we will extract, you know, kind of all the wealth. So the actual term revolution is like incredible. And so many narratives around the fact that, well, we can't stop AI, but, you know, this is the future. It's written in stone. Somehow, you know, we talk a lot about this narrative of inevitability. It's like, AI is inevitable and people just accept that. So having that much power takes away, you know, democratic, you know, any kind of semblance of democracy when you're able to control the narrative so people don't even question. And actually telling anyone, look, the AI, and this is in all policy and definitely in what companies say, this is the future. It's inevitable. Your job is to make the best of it. Is to see how you can make it work for you. You've got to be like the best at being good at this. You've got to be good at adopting. It's become very, very individualistic. And I think this is what's different from, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Where it was less about your responsibility as an individual to be like, to try and come out on top of all this change, and more as like kind of social responsibility of, you know, populations as a whole.
Yeah, there's that quote, which is, you know, tossed around, which is, it's not AI that's going to put you out of a job. It's the person who's better than using it than you, which goes to this individual thing of you need to be better than other people in order to. Can I just go back? You said you talked to politicians, who are sort of interesting bunch. We've had the AI minister on a couple of times, had two of them actually. Yeah. What's your sense talking to politicians? They got their arms around the risks, the opportunities? Are they sort of, you know, sort of rabbit in the headlights with it? Or what's your sense?
I think it goes back to the point I made earlier. They just have fundamentally not understood the role. I think they are so scared of being left behind because of this inevitability narrative that they think their only option is to, and words used by politicians have been things like to embrace AI. Let's embrace this like climate destructive, like, completely extractive technology that looks in practice not like the utopia we were promised, but like deep fake nudes of, you know, young people, of like, you know, kind of exploiting data workers, of, you know, kind of really unfair algorithms, you know, all of these things. It's like, let's embrace AI, whatever that term is. I could talk about that for quite a long time. And that's our only option, because otherwise we're going to be left behind. And in their fear of this being what being left behind means, I think they are have made the decision that they can't focus on, you know, a lot of the bad stuff. It's like turning a blind eye to it. It doesn't hurt that the amount of funding from big tech, from, you know, kind of organizations that don't appear to be big tech, but are still funded by big tech. So some of the, you know, effective altruism movement, which actually purports to want to shut down AI, but is really involved in saying, hey, this is so powerful. Like, so even if you're saying, you know, we need to stop AI because of super intelligence and the rest of it, you're still saying, hey, this stuff is incredible. You know, you need to be owning this.
Do you think there's a danger from, I mean, interesting, from that kind of politician's viewpoint, and as you say, when we had the minister on, this is something we talked about. Do you think there is a danger that if you pump the brake, that if you are too cautious and too restrictive with embracing this innovation and bringing it into the UK, that we would get left behind the likes of the USA, China, India, and because of that, you know, economically we would suffer?
I think that we are going to suffer anyway. So
why? In what way?
Because the amount of wealth in Silicon Valley and through those, you know, few big companies, we are always going to be lackeys to that. There is nothing we can do.
We don't have the sort of sovereign, we don't have a version of Silicon Valley where we're building stuff.
We, you know, I think it's a bit deluded to think that we can actually, you know, kind of compete on that basis. But that's part of the, again, the narrative where, you know, when the EU AI Act was passed, people were saying, oh, this is going to make Europe like incredibly, you know, kind of economically inconvenient. Yeah. And it's like, well, of course they're going to say that, aren't they? Most of all, I think you need to understand that we are just not that bad. We're never going to do that well, however much we embrace it. Secondly, though, do we need to say embrace? Do we need to say let's inject this into our veins, which has also been said in government? Do we need to use such really kind of overinflated language?
Could temper it a bit.
Which loses that nuance, which then stops people kind of going, okay, so maybe we want to do this, but do we want to do that? But maybe actually this is, it takes all the ability and it cuts out civil society because it's saying, we don't want to hear your experiences right now. The other part of that, though, is that there are very big questions about how big a bubble, you know, the circular funding that's going on.
Yeah, we talk about it loads.
People investing each other. So if you're building data centres all over the UK, and that's great because it, you know, kind of probably pumps up your GDP through, you know, investment, but you're going to end up with like them actually not being that useful because the technology is, a lot of the research is that it's not actually, there's no use case of like, hey, this company increased their bottom line, you know, like by X percent through AI, that is actually able to be scrutinized and see what any opportunity costs or any other costs. It's like the case studies are not there. To make the kind of investments that are being made without actually knowing that you're backing them up. Because the thing is, if OpenAI runs out of money, which is very likely, US government might bail them out, you know, other things might happen. Sam Altman's going to be okay, right? He's going to be okay.
Oh, thank God for that.
You know, they're all going to be okay. It's going to be shareholders, it's going to be pension holders, it's going to be the people, they're not going to be okay. And they're the people that the government should be thinking about.
James, you've been working in digital for a while now, haven't you?
Yeah, but you're sort of making me sound old.
You don't need me to do that. The wrinkles in your LinkedIn bio speak for themselves.
So mean.
Hey, I only say it as I was wondering if it's rare to see a tech investment that would be recession-proof.
Well, yeah, it is. But I think AI seems to be the anomaly. Even with all this uncertainty around the economy, business leaders are actually doubling down on their AI spend.
I mean, it is hard to escape the AI chat right now. Seemingly every other article, event, and even podcasts is about it. Trust us, we would know. But when you look at it from an investment perspective, does spend always equal results?
I think the hurdle isn't usually the AI itself, it's trust. Can you trust the data? Can you trust the governance? KPMG's AI Pulse research shows that while the urgency is high, many organisations are actually stuck in pilot mode.
Interesting. And what are KPMG doing to help with that?
Delighted you asked. They're working with leaders to build a foundation of trusted AI governance, focusing on business value from day one so that the technology actually pays off.
So they are the partner that helps organizations making a difference by turning AI potential into enterprise-wide reality.
Yeah, exactly. You actually do listen sometimes. That's incredible.
Occasionally.
If you want to scale with confidence rather than caution, you need to check out their latest insights. Visit kpmg.com/UK to learn more.
What was that? I missed that address.
kpmg.com/UK to learn more.
Yeah, thank you. I'm interested in your take on this, Mr. Chandler, because you're glass half full when it comes to what this technology can do to our world and to our society. And it's obviously a fairly opposite view. And listen, that's what this show is all about. It's really important to hear all different kinds of opinions and views on this, because you're totally right. This is a technology that is, in many ways, being forced upon us, whether we like it or not. It is part of our lives. We didn't necessarily ask for it, but it's here. And I think it's really interesting to get a full perspective on this. You are positive about this space. Does this polarizing view dampen your AI spirit?
I think it's eye-opening in terms of when you sort of look at it through a slightly different lens. I think you can get hooked on the Kool-Aid of, oh, it is improving stuff for me. And because if you sort of believe that, you can go back and find examples of where it is. But, you know, if you take it in the round, of course, there's always going to be opportunity cost. There's always going to be risks that you're exposed to. I think hanging around with you too much has sort of worn me down a little bit. The glass is going. And I absolutely think, as society, we should be able to ask critical questions of things, whether it's moving at 100 miles an hour or not. And I'm not sort of saying, let's pull the handbrake on and pull it all down. But absolutely, we should have the chance to say, something isn't working for me. Or what about this? You know, can't it solve a big problem? Like, I can't see my GP for 3 weeks. Well, surely that's a better thing to be doing than some creative thing that it could sort of do somewhere else. So, yeah, I think... It's a healthy thing to talk about.
So there's a couple of things I wanted to we are going to talk about the AI resist list, because it's really interesting. We're going to come to it, and it is sort of wrapped up in what we're talking about. There's a couple of things I wanted to touch back on, because we've had guests on the show who've said different viewpoints. The environment's one. We've had a few people who have come on in that space, and they've kind of said, actually, AI is not that bad for the environment. Eating red meat is far worse than AI, for
almonds.
Example. Having a few almonds is worse than using ChatGPT for a year. Clearly, you have the viewpoint. AI is pretty bloody bad for the environment. Can you touch on that a little bit more? And kind of from your perspective, why is it awful for the environment?
First of all, you know, I mentioned that we're using this term AI and you must talk about it quite a lot, and have noted that it means many different things. Both in terms of different technologies, fields of research, but, you know, also ideologies and, you know, etc. I think quite often when people conflate like generative AI, you know, and the climate impact with other forms of AI that might help find patterns and the rest of it. So I think that's one thing that people will say is not that bad. It's because they think it might help. But actually generative AI, you know, it's just not helpful at all for solving climate issues. All the research that I've seen, you know, does say it is actually, it's not just in terms of energy consumption. There have been people like, you know, Ketan Joshi, Paris Marx, Sasha Lucioni, who really look into try and find the evidence. And it's very opaque, right? This is part of the problem. So anyone that's saying it's not that bad, like, must have data that the researchers who are trying, just don't have, which is unlikely, right? The research is that it is bad for climate change, and that's because of energy consumption. And you can, you know, use different types of, you know, water or, you know, whatever. But ultimately, that seems to be the case. More to the point, though, is what it's being used for. So if you're eating red meat or you're eating an almond, like, you are actually like getting nourished.
Yes, it has a purpose.
It has a purpose. Yes. You're not creating deep fake of children, yeah, or, you know, whatever. It's like, there's a purpose to, yeah, that. Yeah. Even just like making a pretty picture, do you know, it's like, do we need to do,
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
The other thing is that I think it's the environmental impact beyond the energy consumption. So where they're being built, you know, there's a whole lot. And
they're in water deprived areas.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. And I think all of this is documented, but I think that what it's enabled people to do is to start saying, well, we don't need net zero and we don't need to worry about the climate. And that's the most dangerous thing, because if you're saying we need to let AI burn as much energy as possible, and to do that, we have to get more, you start using more fossil fuels, and we have to roll back our commitments, tear up all the agreements that we had, that's incredibly dangerous, because that is all predicated on, yeah, thinking that at some point some magic solution is going to come up that's going to solve it, and, you know, AI is the answer to that. Yeah. And there's no evidence of that so far. So I think it's not just even a question of the fact the energy it's consuming now. I think it's what it's done to efforts to actually care,
get to that
and
stage
address,
in the first, yeah, place. So we've had Karen Howe on the show before. She has been in the space like you for a long time. And we talked a lot about kind of the empirical building nature of, especially at OpenAI. Karen has championed the AI resist list, which I know that you are a central figure in. Tell us all about this, please.
Yeah. So when Karen wrote Empire of AI, she did a lot of work going around the world, you know, interviewing people who were protesting data centers, you know, and really looking at what the human impact was, data labelers, et cetera, things we've touched on. And really feeling as a journalist that those stories aren't told enough. And I mentioned, you know, the kind of narrative control that you can buy when you have like infinite money,
yeah,
that buys media platforms and, you know, just controls that narrative. So I think for her, it was a question of this kind of journalistic endeavor to uncover more of those stories, because the thing about the inevitability narrative that makes us just go along with things that aren't working for us is because we can't see alternatives. The thing about, you know, us buying this idea of like AI, you know, giving us utopia and universal, you know, basic income, even though in actual fact we're all working harder and, yeah, more precariously and earning less and, you know, things cost more, is that we don't have a better vision of what else we could be having. So if we can surface more of these examples and really get people to think about, well, actually, no, what world do we want to live in? Like, does it involve automation? If it involves automation, who should be controlling that automation? What do we want to automate? What don't we want to automate? What's important to us? And so the more of these stories and examples that we can see, the more we're able to actually start questioning narratives. So we're a narrative at We in AI, we're a narrative organization. We did some work, kind of preprint that we put out October last year, that was built a framework for resisting, refusing, reclaiming and reimagining AI. And what we felt is that a lot of people who have kind of got either a gut feel that this stuff is like not great, that algorithms are, you know, causing young people to harm themselves, or not just young people, and like, would Trump have got in without, you know, kind of social media and the way that that works. So all of these kind of things. And then you've got people that are, you use the term anti-AI, like, I do not think this is this particularly, you know, I don't want to be surveyed. I don't want Palantir to have my data. So maybe in a slightly different place. And then other people that are doing this kind of creative reimagining. And then people who are, you know, really questioning the whole ideology of flattening, you know, of everyone being reduced to data points and flattening it. Yeah. So you've got this really wide range of people across many different industries, many different use cases with many different impacts. And the problem is that we don't see that we're all in the same battle.
I see.
And so this framework is basically saying you may just be somebody at a job that is, you know, maybe being surveyed by your workplace, or maybe having to use a tool that you know is like causing, you know, misinformation, or, you know, whatever it is. Or you may be somebody that is, you know, really on the front line of harm, but you don't see yourselves as in the same fight. And that means that this inevitability narrative, so nothing is inevitable unless it's like There is no way to stop it.
Yeah.
And it is guaranteed to happen. And yet we say AI is inevitable. Mm. But if all of these people kind of who are either resisting, so, you know, could be a very passive resistance of like, well, I'm going to say that I've done this. And I, you know, it could be really small stuff or putting a little sticker on something or really big stuff that are trying to opt out of stuff, that are trying to get off big tech or just trying to, you know, think of better ways that we could be creating and owning AI, owning our data, data co-ops, you know, what do we want to use AI for? If we can think of how many millions that we are, why do we think that we don't have a right to like come together and say things can be better? So when people say that, you know, it's kind of quite a negative thing to resist AI and the AI resist list is cataloguing people that are resisting it, it's actually a really positive thing because it's saying all the people doing all of these things because they believe things can be better than they are now.
And is there like an objective? Is there an end goal or steer or is it more just a gathering of individuals?
Yeah, so we found that we were working. So as we and AI, we were pulling together a database based on our resisting, refusing, reclaiming, reimagining framework with a similar idea of like showing, so, you know, changing the narrative to say, no, there are things you can do because people patronise me the whole time and go, Tanya, it's really sweet that you care so much about people. but at the end of the day, you've just got to accept that, you know, this is it. And you've just got it. And it's just like, well, no, actually, that's really naive. You know,
like that lights a fire underneath you.
Yeah,
having
exactly.
Talked to you in the last 30 minutes, I can't imagine
Oh, no, I've been so patronized. It's like, well, actually, maybe it's quite naive to think that there is nothing that you can do. So we thought we'd surface all of these examples of like, well, no, this is something you can do. And actually, this is a successful use case. You know, this is a data center that has been stopped, or this is an algorithm that has been banned, or this is, you know, there are things people can do.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Karen was creating this. So we merged with Karen's project, which was with the York Refugee Law Center, which out of Canada, with the DARE Institute run by Timnit Gebru. And there's some, you know, great researchers there. And we were all working on we work in different versions of the same database. So we came together, which actually is like an exact example of that there are people doing the same things with the same thoughts, but it's only when you come together that you have a bit more, you know, kind of power. So we combined the reclaiming, you know, refusing, reimagining framework with the pillars on the AI resist list. Karen and her, you know, kind of group had come up with 9 pillars that uphold the empires of AI. So data centers, data, labor, narrative, surveillance, etc., and ways that people were challenging them.
Right.
And then we joined together and we and AI, the team there, we're a volunteer, non-profit, unfunded organization, but, you know, a lot of very passionate people, did the research to then find exemplar organizations, initiatives, people that are working on things around the world. So 7 continents, working with journalists, working with Karen, who really spearheaded it, so that we could see what's going on around the world. Then cataloging, listing, speaking to all of them. We didn't scrape anyone website. We had conversations with all of them as kind of research to say, okay, so this now gives us a picture of the number of different actions that you can take that, you know, some you might need to be a lawyer for or have a legal representative because there's a lot on law, but some you might just, you know, you can be an artist or just someone who can ask questions or, you know, kind of create a local movement. So a massive range of different actions, catalogue them, catalogue which pillar they were against, the different geographies, the different approach to resistance, and now basically have a resource that people can, as a kind of journalistic resource that people can look and go, okay, right, this is things we can do. And really importantly, it has a section on possible futures. So this is people that are doing the work of thinking about what world we want to live in. So things like permacomputing, a completely different way of computing, indigenous language models, so small language models, ones that are not owned by, you know, Google or OpenAI or, you know, whatever, but are the data is owned, managed, you know, by the community for the community.
After everything we've talked about, what gives you hope?
Well, I mean, it's been incredibly hopeful to see everyone come together. Well, when we wrote the paper back in October, we were stunned at how it resonated with people. So we just put it on an open science publishing platform, you know, as a small, unfunded UK volunteer organisation. And it just kept getting downloaded. And people all over the place, oh, yeah, no, it's not inevitable. Like, this is... I have a right to say what future I want. So that really was quite encouraging. Then seeing the response to the AI Resist List launching, which again is people kind of saying, oh yeah, I want to do more of that because I want things to be better. And I think they can be. And that is really, really hopeful. And I think for anyone that kind of says, look, we've just got to make the best of this. And if we're particularly civic minded, then the best we can do is like, bring someone else along with us, get someone else a seat on that train, like drag them aloft. You mentioned earlier the narrative of like, if you don't use AI well, someone using it better than you are is you know, gonna take you well. Number one, AI has never taken a single job, right? So it's like this whole AI is gonna take your job thing. People decide to automate. AI, this like offloading the responsibility to AI is part of the narrative work we've done. We have another project, Better Images of AI, and we also have one about to launch, which is Metaphors of AI, which looks at the visual imagery, the language, the ways that make us think that it's the AI that is the issue, not the people making the decisions. So what gives me hope is working with people that are saying, we want to be making decisions and we want to be making regenerative, you know, decisions that are about, you know, regenerative technologies, that are about public good, that are about not growth for growth's sake, because that's how someone makes money, but like what we actually, growth of the things that we value.
Mm. I was just thinking, because I'm fascinated by this, do you use AI? Would you ever open up ChatGPT and ask it for a recipe?
No. I got fed up with Grammarly. So Grammarly was like one of those tools that, you know, you were using without realizing what most people for years. And I kind of had already stopped you because it was just really annoying how it was trying to make me say something that I wasn't what I was trying to say. Mm. And I think that the same I would say for ChatGPT. We have done experiments. We have looked at things, you know, and we did some research for Joseph Rowntree Foundation a couple of years ago on how charities, obviously we're in the charities, you know, and non-profit sector, how grassroots organisations were using AI. And as part of that, you know, we were kind of part of the data set. And the narrative at the time was like, charities have to use AI because it means they can campaign more, they can do more fundraising bids, they can, you know, send out more newsletters and mail. The problem is, everyone else is doing that too. And there's no more money. In fact, a lot of your money is going to the tech platforms that are now enabling you to do the same thing that everyone else is doing, but not, there's no more money. The funder is now just having to use AI to like process all the fundraising applications. Yeah, and so what you get in all of that and what we found is that you're becoming further away from understanding your served community, from understanding what it is you do, what competencies you have, what you want to say, what your message is. And actually that's the thing that can't be replicated. Yeah. So your short answer is no, we don't. It is a position in the sense of like, do we think it's worth the kind of upholding a system that is making money for so generative AI, this is for some of these really egregious, you know, kind of companies that, you know, anyone that's read books like, you know, Careless People and the rest of it, you know, know that they are, it's not just saying, oh, big is bad, you know, it's like they are using really egregious tactics. So it's not just a kind of thing saying we don't want to be complicit in this system of displacing workers and work and stealing stuff from the internet that people have labored for and using it for my own purposes. That is a position, but it is also the fact that it just has never worked for us. And you'll always get someone going along, oh, it's because you don't know how to prompt properly. And it's like, well, if I had to spend ages and ages and ages like trying to work out the exact precise prompt that is going to get the exact nuances,
you could have written the thing.
Then
now,
why not just write it?
Well, we'd usually finish with a game called
ChatGPT Roulette.
ChatGPT Roulette, where we ask people to tell us the last thing they asked their LLM of choice. well, we won't need to be
quite
so you can say
quite
five minutes today.
Tanya, that was fascinating. Thank you.
Well, say thanks so much
thanks
for joining us, Tanya.
Again, for giving space to this kind of conversation. I think for us, this is really important because this space is often taken away from people because, you know, it's kind of a bit taboo to actually ask certain questions. So I appreciate the space.
Pleasure.
And we appreciate you. Thank you so much. Wow. Well, that was very, very interesting. And James, I'm slightly worried.
Don't need to be.
I'm worried I'm not going to be left with a podcast co-host. The yin and yang of AI might be destroyed because I feel like you are now pro burn the establishment down.
No, not quite yet. It was fascinating. And I think if we had more time, I think you could sort of, you know, pick into it a little bit more. I do think that they're the right questions to be asking, like this inevitability that it has to be frenetic and fast paced and all the rest of it. I don't think pull the handbrake on completely. I think you use the term sort of pump the brake a little bit. You know, it might not be a bad thing to do. Whose role is it to do that? Is it sort of society? Should it be politicians? Should it be people like us? But yeah, a whole list of very interesting questions that you can be asking without getting sort of too carried away by it, or which, you know, perhaps I'm guilty of sometimes.
I think there is an element of, for good or bad, and I probably think bad, Pandora's box has been opened, and I do think it's actually quite difficult to stuff all that AI back in and to shut the door on it.
Toothpaste tube.
So, I do think there is an element of inevitability about this, despite what Tanya was saying. That said, it's good to question, it's good to debate, it's good to challenge.
Do you think she really doesn't use AI at all? I just find
I do. I do. I think.
I find that staggering.
If we're being honest, and I'm sure Tanya would agree, we didn't talk about it, but I'm sure there is an element of principle about it. I can't believe that there aren't certain things that would improve Tanya's life by using AI. But I also respect the fact that, you know, this is her stance on this, and actually maybe she would feel like she wasn't being true to what she stands for by using it, even if it was going to help her out.
I really admired her sort of passion for it. I mean, she absolutely believes in this stuff. You know, the fact that she came out of the corporate world, set up this organisation, just the way she talked, you can sort of see it in her, can't you? She passionately believes this stuff.
I suppose it's like if you're a vegan, right? You might be a vegan not because you don't like having chicken, but because you don't believe that's the way, and actually be a lot easier and cheaper and whatever if you could eat chicken, but you don't. So maybe, you know, it is one of those things where she's not doing it because of the principles that she believes in. But
shouldn't have used the red meat example, maybe.
I know, that was, I know. I tell you what, I should be recruited for the AI resist list.
Trying to pull it down every week.
Having to put up with all your AI stuff every week. I should be firmly on the AI resist list.
You know, we need back on after that, just a bit of like, get it back in our veins.
Oh, Phil Rowley.
Yeah, 100%. Getting back show, on. Need a bit of a AI back rub.
Bit of frith, a little bit of AI frothery on there. it did remind me a bit of Rogue One. You know,
what's like Rogue One
and Andor, like the Star Wars
story.
The
ones with the ears, Spock.
That's Star Trek. No, yeah, Star Wars, but like the revolution. Viva la revolution. The AI revolution. Tear the tech system down.
Okay, you're not talking to Tanya again. Okay. Getting a bit. Okay.
All right. On that note, we'll say goodbye before I get too excited by the AI anti-revolution.
Hose him down.
We will be back on Friday with all the latest news from the world of AI. For now, we'll say big thanks to Tanya. Big thanks to you for listening. A big thanks to producer Molly Carter and team AI Having a Clue. We're back on Friday, James. For now,
stay curious, stay revolutionary.
Viva la revolution!